Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
Today on Maine Calling, a conversation with writer Anne Lamott. Anne Lamott has just written her 20th book. Some of her work is fiction, some not. She's known for covering big topics such as alcoholism, teenage drug use, single motherhood, and for her strong personal faith and self-deprecating humor. Her latest book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Through a series of essays, Lamott explores how love raises us up when we're floored by despair, and is what gives us our belief in tomorrow. Love is not always the easiest choice, she argues, but is the right one. The evidence is gathered from her own life experiences and personal observations. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Anne Lamott about the book, about her faith, and about finding humor in subjects that are complicated and uncomfortable. Maine Calling is coming up. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. In her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love, best-selling author Anne Lamott examines the importance of love in our lives. She's the author of 20 books, novels, and nonfiction, many of which are New York Times bestsellers, including Bird by Bird, Rosie, and Dusk, Night, Dawn. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Anne Lamott, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Keith.
I have to ask you first for your take on the eclipse for a couple of reasons. One is I know that you believe it's important for us to look up. But for the other reason is that I sort of noted that there were sort of maybe it's more nuanced than this, but there were sort of two camps of eclipse watchers. There were those who saw it as an astronomical event in which the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, providing a rare opportunity to view the corona, or they felt it. They cried. They said they felt small. And it seemed like it was kind of a reveal of what kind of goggles we're looking through, other than the, flimsy paper ones that we used yesterday. I wondered what your take was on the event.
Well, I thought it was an amazing astronomical event, but I was on in a middle row of a plane over Denver while it was occurring, so it wasn't a heavy spiritual or it wasn't a phenomenon for me, and I didn't have Wi-Fi, so I couldn't even watch it on my iPad. Oh. But I would have loved to have. I wrote about an eclipse, but it was a worldwide lunar eclipse it must be 25 years ago in Traveling Mercies, because it was that same kind of energy that everybody was talking about it for a week beforehand, and it was experienced by billions of people. But I didn't have anything to do. I didn't even get to see the one yesterday, except for I did have the goggles, so I was going to wear them all day around New York today, but I forgot to.
They're quite fashionable.
Totally. Yeah.
So I'm sure, many people who are listening right now already know all about you, but for those who don't, you write a lot about kind of being a sensitive kid, anxious, in a way, I guess, that you really believe the world is not a safe place. Where did that come from? And how has it sort of shaped how you, what you write about and how?
Well, the world was not a safe place for me when I was a little kid. I mean, externally, I was born in 54, so I was raised in the 50s and early 60s. We were under our desks all the time because of the threat from Russia of nuclear war, as if sitting underneath the desk was going to be an effective protection. But anyway, my parents were very unhappy with each other, and so I grew up as sort of the flight attendant to my family, trying to help everybody feel better about themselves. And also, I had this crazy kinky hair, and I got bullied a lot. And boys would pedal by on their bikes and throw stuff at me and shout words about my hair. So the world really was not a very safe place. There was a lot of alcohol at my house, and the children who grow up around a lot of alcohol tend to be hyper vigilant, and you're preparing for things to go south on you and for everything to get very weird very quickly. And no one mentioned to me that it was not my responsibility to help change the mood or help people's spirits lift. And so I, set about trying to do that. So it was a very kind of a chaotic childhood for me.
And then that the alcoholism that you grew up in, eventually you discovered you also had within you, and it was a struggle, from what your 20s, or was it earlier than that?
It was earlier than that. I always drank differently than my girlfriends did in high school. They would drink to get high. They'd drink a glass of red wine mixed with 7-Up, and I would drink two or three. And it was the 60s, so we were all smoking the non-habit forming marijuana that I then smoked for about 25 years on a daily basis, until I got sober, which was almost 38 years ago in 1986. But the people I was growing up with, they drank to get high, to get sort of silly and goofy and a little bit stoned. And I drank to mood alter. And when they went downstairs to get snacks, I finished their drinks.
I read an account of you recalling that I think it was the first time you drank a beer. You and your best friend. Can you share that?
Well, we'd had sip my I have two brothers. We'd had sips of beer and wine because my parents were very erudite and avant-garde, and so my mom was from Europe. You were allowed to have sips. But I remember my friend Lisa Kampmeyer stole two 16-ounce beers of some sort, and they might have been malt. And from her father's wet bar, which was very big in the 60s. And I remember standing by the side of the road, and we chugged them. And it was like when Dorothy steps out of into Oz from the barn, from Kansas City, and everything went into color. I was about 12. I'd skipped a grade. I was very bright back then, and I'd skipped a grade, and I'd never fit in, and I felt funny looking and weird and different then. And that beer went down, and I felt pretty and part of, and that was what I went after for the next 20 years till I got sober. That feeling of peace and prettiness and self-esteem and just that feeling of belonging to, being part of.
Let's see, Anne, are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah.
Okay, sorry. You were breaking up a little bit, and we may need to reestablish the connection, but we'll forge on for now. When was it in? When was the realization when you thought, well, that feeling of being in the colored part of Oz was no longer working, and that life was actually getting worse.
Well, I remember in being 21 with my best friend at that time, which was in a small little hippie community, and just laughing and saying, "Oh, we're both alcoholics." And I was 21, and because every time I drink, which was every day, I'd get really drunk because I like to get really drunk when I'm drinking. I don't mind being impaired as long as I'm with a guy who likes that in a girl, and And we just laughed about it, though, because there was no, in the farthest thing from my mind was that I would ever stop drinking. I really loved it so much. But then there's a man in the Bay Area where I'm from named Dr. Gill, who said to me that there are three stages. There's the fun and trouble, and then there's the trouble. And I was in fun and trouble most of my 20s. I was disgracing myself and in public. I got my first book published relatively young at 26. And so I was out in public after that, and I was doing stuff that was just embarrassing to the publishing house. And I just thought it was funny, you know, or fun. And then by my dad died when I was 25. And I was pretty much in trouble, I'd say, from then on. They sort of crossed over the fun and trouble and the trouble. And then I was in a lot of trouble for the 5 or 6 years before I quit drinking.
You mentioned your father, your first book, and you started writing quite young, and your first book deal was in your 20s, and that was the book about the death of your father.
Yes. Well, it was about the certain death of my father, who had a metastasized melanoma, who no one back then was surviving. So we knew he was going to die, but I wrote the novel Hard Laughter as if he might make it.
And that I had read or seen that the book didn't really necessarily sell all that well, but you noticed that readers responded to it. Is that kind of when you realized that maybe people had this sort of hunger to read about, you know, honest thoughts, honest discussion of topics that they were not getting?
Yes, exactly. Well, the main thing that happened for Hard Laughter, first of all, my dad got to read it before his mind got really riddled by the brain cancer, but he got to read it in galley form the year before it was published. And then I got this amazing review in the New York Times book review section by Ann Tyler, who was probably one of my most influential writers when I was coming up. But then, no, it didn't sell. It sold several thousand copies, I think. But people had not started talking about death openly in 1980, and they really didn't until the AIDS epidemic and tragedy. But so I had gone to the library when my dad got sick, because I usually the first thing I did when confronted with anything difficult was to just go to the library and read somebody else on it, like womanhood, feminism, you know, politics. And there was really nothing in the library about a family going through a terminal illness and keeping their heads above water and even keeping their senses of humor. And so I wrote one, and I've said for all these years since, 45 years since, write the book you'd like to come upon. So I wrote a book about what it was really, really like for the family, and some of it was sort of funny, you know, and kind of maybe graveyard humor. But and then people were coming up to me after it was published saying, "Thank you so much. My family went through that, or my family's going through that, or we just got the bad news that." And I noticed that it was helpful to a certain kind of reader. And then my next novel was called Rosie, and in it, Rosie, who's a little girl, is her best friend's father exposes himself to her. And of course, there'd been the tree, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, where that happens to the protagonist. But it really wasn't being talked about. And dozens of women came up to me and said something like that had happened to them, or they'd been molested as children by someone in the family or by a family friend. And that really was incredible, because it's so great for this stuff to get talked about. It's half of the solution is that we don't stay silent anymore, and that you get to say what is truly going on instead of the way that you're supposed to respond to it. You know, like with a death in the family, you're supposed to respond from this very highly spiritual or psychologically grounded place, but that happens about a quarter of the time in real life. So I learned the power of just saying what was really really true for me.
And what is it, do you think, about, you know, laughing in the face of painful truths that we often would rather, you know, not acknowledge? What is that? What do you think that does? Well, what does it do for you?
Well, for me, it breaks the trance of hopelessness and of the terror of what's going on, to get your sense of humor back. I've always said laughter is carbonated holiness. So once you're laughing with a friend again, you're in an altered state that is just so much better than being in the pinball state of your own mind, trying to find peace in a situation that's really scary and difficult.
This book is about love. It's about all kinds of different love and how it comes in and out of our lives. But you quote the poet William Blake, who said that essentially we are here to endure the beams of love. What does that mean, and why does it resonate with you?
Well, there's a whole chapter in somehow about it, but the short form is that because I grew up with a family that was really so dysfunctional and unhappy, I was always the person that brought love to everybody. As I said, I was the little flight attendant for the family and for the world. And that meant that I was excellent at just like kind of being the mom in every situation of loving and cuddling. And so when I first read that line, I was in my 20s. We are here to learn to endure the beams of love. Oh, it was one of the most radical things I'd ever heard, because it said to me, you're here to be love, not just to be the love provider. You're here to be aware of all the love in the world, all the love in your little galaxy, all the love in your heart, all the love surrounding you. And that was, and I was already on a really deep spiritual path by then. I converted, you know, I'm a Sunday school teacher now, but I converted drunk in 1985. But I'd always had a really deep spiritual longing inside of me for everything but Christianity, which I desperately tried not to be seduced by. But we are here to learn to endure the beams of love. It means you take now off your protective armor. I quote in the book something my friend, the comedian Duncan Trussell, said, which was that when you first meet him, you're meeting your bodyguard. And so what the quote meant to me was that we're here to take off the armor and to ask the bodyguard to go wait in the library for us for a while, and to practice being vulnerable, to practice letting love in, you know, through osmosis, through our skin, our biggest organ, through our heart, through our eyes. And I think that line changed me forever.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Anne Lamott. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. My guest today is best-selling author Anne Lamott. We're discussing her latest book, which just came out, called Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Anne's the best-selling author of 20 books. You could join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainpublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. Anne, I thought we might start this segment, if you would. I think you have a section of the book that you would agree to read for us. I'm not sure which one it is, but if you want to do that now.
Okay. I'm just going to read the first page of the book. It's called The Overture. My husband said something a few years ago that I often quote, 80% of everything that is true and beautiful can be experienced on any 10-minute walk. Even in the darkest and most devastating times, love is nearby if you know what to look for. It does not always appear at first to be lovely, but instead may take the form of a hot mess or a snoring old dog or someone you have sworn to never, ever forgive for a possibly very good reason, if you ask me. But mixed in will also be familiar signs of love, wings, good-hearted people, cats when they're in the right mood, a spray of wildflowers, a cup of tea. What are we even talking about when we talk about love? What is it? I asked a six-year-old friend of mine. Oh, it's just this stuff, he said, rolling his eyes. I think that's right. Love is caring, affection, and friendliness, of course, compassion, and a generous heart. It is also some kind of energy or vibration, because everything is the same stuff moving at different speeds from glaciers to six-year-old boys. I wish the movement of love in our lives more closely resembled the grace of a ballerina, but no, love mainly tromps and plops, falls over and tiptoes through our lives. Love looks like us, and that can be a little daunting. Love is why we are here at all.
And what's a great part to launch this then, this volume, this series of essays, on love. There's also a little bit later on in that, in this same section, I think, is you write, love is the warmth we feel in the presence of a favorite aunt, the kindness of a waitress, the warmth of a hand that pulls us back to our feet when the loss of love has all but destroyed us. It is this stuff which any kid and most poets will tell you we experience in our hearts. And then next graph, nonsense, you may say. Love arises and is regulated in a part of the brain called the amygdala. How right you are once again, and how happy that must make you, as it often does me, and why I so need the intervention of love. And I love that section because it sort of points to this thing that we do often, I think, that when we're heartbroken, it makes us feel better to reduce feelings to like some sort of temporary or emotions to a temporary biochemical reaction in the brain that will pass. You know, it's there to help us survive, but if that's all it is. And how would you say we should, while that's useful to do, that we don't lose, the feelings of love, as painful as they sometimes can be?
Well, yeah, I think that's right. And also we do lose the feelings of love when things hit us hard enough, when we lose love, if we've lost some, if we've had a breakup or somebody that with whom we can't live without dies. And when we have an unsurvivable loss, how do we survive that? And it is just the end of the world. There's no getting around it. If you've grown into adulthood, and certainly I'm 70 tomorrow, I'm still in my 60s.
Happy birthday.
As we speak.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you. I'm still in my 60s, so savoring it. And how do we come through? A lot of the book is about that, but we breathe, we go left foot, right foot, left foot, breathe. And we pick up the 200-pound phone and we say to someone, I'm not okay. Do you have a minute? And we do radical self-care. We take the hot bath. We get ourselves a cup of tea and we cry and cry and cry until we don't have to anymore. And if I were God's West Coast representative, I'd have a magic wand and I would tap people on the head and let them be over the deep grief and the deep loss. But it doesn't work that way. But the way that love appears to us at those times helps us not go completely under. It's a bitful little flame in the darkness, and the darkness does not ever overwhelm that little flame completely.
I want to go to the phones, and let's bring in Steph, who is calling from Portland. Steph, welcome.
Yes, hi, thank you. Hi, Anne, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I love your TED Talk, and there's a moment in it when you mentioned if, for example, somebody wanted to be portrayed better or more complementary in your work, then they should have behaved better in life. And I'm curious how you kind of negotiate that in your own work, how not to maybe, you know, come off as vengeful when speaking mm-hmm. the truth about bad behavior that you've observed or lived through, I guess, mm-hmm. at the hands of others, but while at the same time speaking the truth. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you approach that?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, of course, you have to be careful about slander and libel, too. And so my experience, I mean, Somehow is my 20th book. And my experience is that if you change people's height and hair color, they never recognize themselves. They don't remember having said such awful things. Also, this is why I've written 7 novels besides these 13 books of, you know, Bird by Bird and Operating Instructions, and then these collections of spiritual meditations. And so that's where fiction comes in, is that you write about a family that is not your own, although it actually was. All the material sprang from them, but it was that you write about the family down the street. And I don't write anything that I think would hurt anybody that I love. I'm very, very careful about not invading anybody's privacy and telling the stories that are theirs to tell. So, you know, I've run every single story about Sam since he was about 10 past him to make sure he felt okay about me publishing it. And, you know, I have a lot of people that help me with my work, and they would always point out if they thought something was a little bit harsher than I want it to be.
Yeah. Steph, did that help?
That's great. Yes, I think a really human way to think about it, to kind of, you know, walk the line between the truth and not hurting. I love it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Email from Toki. I've been so inspired by your book, Bird by Bird. Would you speak to your current writing practice? I guess we should start with Bird by Bird, which you've mentioned is taken from a piece of advice that your father gave to your brother when he was young and was sort of panicking while working on a school project. Can you tell that story and the Bird by Bird origin story, and then we can apply it to your writing?
Yeah. In Northern California, in fourth grade, you write your first research papers, one each semester. Before then, in third grade, I'm sure it was the same in Maine, you have paper that has half of the page devoted to the illustration. But in fourth grade, you research something, and one thing was the Capitol, which is Sacramento. You do the Sacramento trip. And the second one was birds. And my older brother hated school and homework, and you had the whole semester to research it, and he hadn't started it. So we were at our little one-room cabin, and he was in tears, and because it was due the next Monday. It was a Saturday morning. I'll never forget. My dad sat down with him. My dad was a writer, and put his arms around John, and he said, just take it bird by bird. Just read. We had Roger Torrey Peterson and Audubon there and National Geographic with lots of photos of birds. And he said, just study the chickadees and then write in your own words. Tell me about them. And then we'll make an illustration. And now so I want you to read about great blue herons and Roger Torrey Peterson. And then tell me about them in your own words. And that's pretty much how I've written everything I've ever written, is just small pieces at a time. In Bird by Bird, I talk about the 1-inch picture frame, and you have a 1-inch picture frame on your desk, and you only have to write as much as you can see through that 1-inch picture frame. One passage, one scene, one one page, and it served me well.
We have a note from a listener. Maybe you will recognize the name. It says, "I'm so excited. It's so exciting to hear you on Maine Calling today. Memories of being your neighbor in that, quote, hippie enclave in the 1970s flood my mind now, most especially how much time we spent sitting on each other's steps, smoking and talking about something we shared, our weird hair. Witnessing the writing of your first book, Hard Laughter, was an amazing experience. And this is from Jennifer.
Jennifer Dunn, I wonder.
I don't know. She
had silky, beautiful blonde hair. But anyway, I was drunk and stoned that entire time. And I do remember sitting on some stairs with a Jennifer smoking. I smoke Camel non-filters. Oh, my God. I quit 38 years ago yesterday.
Wow, you know the day.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Because it was close to your...
It was my dad's birthday. He'd already passed, but I quit on his birthday 38 years ago.
The caller earlier mentioned the TED Talk. Mm-hmm. This is the talk about the list of truths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we can't get into all 12, but I would like to just touch on a few. So the first one, that life is a paradox, as you put it. It brings floods and babies and acne and Mozart all swirled together. And this is sort mm-hmm. of, I read that or I watched that and I thought, well, I think we all know this. And yet we don't really. We always seem like we're shocked when the bad mm-hmm. things come along. And so it isn't, we realize it, but we don't really quite get it.
Yeah, I think my reaction is that can't be true. What would work for me is if everything was sort of organized, like in a silverware holder, so that all the wonderful things were where the knives go, and then the difficult things where the big forks go, and then the catastrophes where the salad forks go, and so on. And it's not, life is not like that. It's as if all the silverware got dropped on the floor together, and sometimes things are so hard. I mean, human life can be so hard, but you grow up with TV and magazines and radio telling you that if you just do this, or you just lose the last 10 pounds, or if you just start to date the right person or marry somebody or lease the right car, you're going to be fulfilled, and you're going to have really, really good days, mostly almost every day. And that is just that is the great palace lie. It's not out there. It's an inside job. But so it's just such a mixed grill. And it's such a relief when you get that, because otherwise you think everybody else is having a pretty easy time of it, and you're not, you know. And you must have been gone the day they passed out the owner's manual for being a human, you know, in second grade when you were home with chickenpox. So for me, it was a big relief when I realized that I wouldn't be served by comparing my insides to other people's outsides, that everybody's in the same boat. It's hard here.
Yeah, and social media has really not done much to help us with this. It sort of reifies that untruth. Right.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, listen, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, more of our conversation with Anne Lamott. The number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shorthol. Joining me today, Anne Lamott, author of 20 books, including bestsellers Help, Thanks, Wow, Dusk, Night, Dawn, Traveling Mercies, and Bird by Bird, as well as 7 novels. Her new book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Share your questions or comments. Email us at talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I'd like to talk about your personal faith, your Christianity, I guess, if we will, we'll just call it faith. How did you find it? Where did it come from? Because it wasn't growing up, right? My parents were atheists.
Yeah, and intellectuals, left-wing intellectuals, and very avant-garde. Um, It's a funny story. I wrote about it a lot in Traveling Mercies. I was living on a houseboat in Sausalito, which I know a lot of your listeners have been to. It's a go-to place if you get to San Francisco. And I was living in a 10 by 10 houseboat. I was just drunk and stoned all the time. I'd published 3 books. I was dirt poor. And there was a flea market across the highway over in an area that is completely impoverished. And mostly people of color live there. As a result of having moved to Marin during the Great Migration to work in the shipyard, which was called Marin Ship in the 40s. And I'd go over to this flea market because when you're hungover, you just want greasy food. It has to be deep fried and strong coffee. And then I'd hear this music wafting out of this ramshackle, crummy-looking little church with a Charlie Brown tree in front of it. But I could hear the gospel music and the music of the civil rights movement that my parents had been very involved in, the hymns of the Deep South, like "We Shall Not Be Moved" and "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," and "We Shall Overcome." And it was like in the cartoons. I think I'm a lot older than you, but when I was coming up, there were always these cartoons where there'd be a man sitting on a lounger in the TV, and his wife would have put a pie in the windowsill to cool, and it would have this aromatic finger of smoke, and it would always tap the guy on his chest and beckon to him, and he'd get up and he'd follow the finger of smoke out to the windowsill, and then he'd eat the pie, and then he'd get in trouble with the nagging wife, right? It was a meme. And I followed that to this little church, and it was so incredible. It was mostly Black people, and nobody wanted me to sign up for anything or to come to Bible study or to take a Bible. They could just see that I was hurting, that I was not okay. I weighed 25 pounds less than I do now, and I was bulimic. I was not okay. And they could see that. And they just got me water. And they talked gently to me and sweetly to me. And so I kept coming back because I had run out of any more good ideas about how to save or fix myself, which is pretty much what grace looks like, I think. It's like you're exhausted and you run out of any more good ideas. And then so I'd walk back to the house, but I'd always leave for the Jesus part because my parents had been so anti-Christianity. And I am too, in terms of the modern Christianity of the extremists and the fundamentalists. And I absolutely believe that all the problems of the world are caused by the fundamentalists of every religion. But these people were like so sweet and progressive. It had been a sanctuary during Vietnam. And anyway, one day, I always left before the sermon because I just felt like, God, all my friends would desert me. And one day I was walking back to my houseboat. I was on the pier and this is going to sound crazy. I just felt Jesus like running along beside me like a stray cat, wanting me to let it in. Now, I'm not stupid. And I know that if you give the little stray cat affection and maybe a bowl of milk, you suddenly, it's not a stray cat. It's now your cat. So I put it off. I said, no, I don't even see you. And then I don't know why. I guess it was the movement of grace. I stopped and I said, okay, you can come in. And that was the day that I decided to see what it might be like to follow Jesus. And that was in 1985. So then I had kind of a gap year at my little church, which is called St. Andrew Presbyterian in Marin City, California. And you can all meet me there on Sundays. It's on Zoom. And every book, it acknowledges St. Andrew, so you can easily find it. And I never looked back. I just went, okay, whatever, I'm in.
Let's go to Joyce in Kennebunk. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi, Ann. You know, I feel like this is serendipitous because I heard you the other day on, I think it was the TED Radio Hour. So I recognized your voice, and I was coming downstairs from my office, and I'm like, that's Anne Lamott. Oh, my gosh, I've missed half the show. And I just finished reading Traveling Mercies, Plan B, and I'm like 20 pages from the end of Grace Eventually. So I'm steeped in your journey right now. And I couldn't pass up the opportunity to just say thank you because it's just like, well, it's the name of another book of yours, but it's just like operating instructions for being a human being, you know? And I'm one of these people who's always fighting the tendency to worry about what's coming next and just to stay in the present. And somehow, somewhere in all of your writing, it teaches me how to do that. It's like just, I don't know if you're the one who said this or someone else who said, you know, life, it's not like life is, you know, going along great, and then something bad happens, interrupted. It's like, it's all your life.
Yeah.
It's just life.
Yep.
I don't know if that was you, but it sounds like you. Was that you?
Uh-huh. It sounds like me.
Yeah, it does. And I have it up on my wall now because that's just, you know, that and be present is what I have stuck all over my house because that's one of my challenges. Anyway, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to just speak with you and say thank you. And, you know, you are just a prime, I don't know, prime driver, prime teacher in my life. I want to say right now, but probably ongoing. So thank you. That's all.
Oh, thank you. What a great call to get. I really am grateful for it. Yeah. I mean, we are so educated and socialized away from real life, from that life is messy and life can be hard. And we rarely know what we're doing, or we don't often know what we're doing. And the culture and our teachers and our parents tell us we need to know what we're doing. We need to make decisions. It needs to be the right decision because you shouldn't change your mind. It makes you look weak. And the culture tells you if you look a certain way, that you're acceptable. And if you're not, then it makes sense that you have bad self-esteem and try to do better. And just, oh, all the lies. And it's just such a long road back to the fact that life is just so lifey some days, you know, it's messy and it's painful. Your feelings get hurt, or the culture looks at you with bad eyes because of who you are, what you look like, or whatever. And it's so amazing for me, I'll be 70 tomorrow. And it's so amazing to have really gotten on a cellular level that I belong here, that I deserve all the oxygen I want to take up, and that I get to be big and juicy and wild if I decide to be, instead of how women were taught to be in the 50s, which was small and polite and adorable. And but anyway, I really appreciate your call. I'm so glad if what I say and write has been helpful for you. And I just want to say the last person who called, who had the weird hair like me and who I smoked with, was Jennifer Van Dusen.
That's correct. And she wrote back. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad to be reminded of her. I remember her fondly.
Yeah. Yeah. We wanted to point that out. Jennifer Van Dusen. Joyce, thank you so much. Let's take another call. And then I have a question for you about grace. But we'll go to Karen next. Hi, Karen. Welcome.
Hi. This is kind of a thrill of a lifetime for me because Anne Lamott is my writing hero and human hero.
Oh, thank you. Wow.
Thank you for just to hear your voice. I'm on my way to an appointment. I happened to turn on the radio and thought, I can't miss this opportunity to say I was an art teacher for 38 years, taught English, and have read, I think, all your books, and I'm writing my own book, and you gave me the courage to do that.
Good. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Now, my son and his fiance and best friend and business partner have a something you will love called awritingroom.com. And it's 500 people that are writing their own books. And they are gathered online at awritingroom.com. And I'm teaching there a lot. I talk there a lot, but I'm not the important thing about it. They are. And they are encouraging each other. They form little groups. My editor, Jake Morrissey, goes on and talks about what an editor would really like to see when you submit a manuscript, and agents go on and tell you what the same thing, and they have time. I do a lot of prompts there, and you can just plug in for a month. It's a little expensive, I think, but a month isn't, and you can get about 5 talks I've given on bird by bird. I did a writing a book club there. And if you like bird by bird, then it's me sitting and talking about it for an hour and a half and what each section means. And but boy, I hope that if you're writing your own book, if you don't go do a writing room or do online stuff like that, those kind of communities, that I hope you have somebody that'll read your stuff for you, because without that, it's very hard to keep on going, to not lose confidence, to, you know, all the bad voices. My husband wrote a book called Better Days about the inner critic. His name's Neil Allen, and it's about that bad. If you're a writer, you know this voice, I'm positive. It's sitting on your shoulder and it tells you, oh, this isn't going to go anywhere, or I don't have an agent, or this is, there's thousands of other books like this, blah, blah, blah. But in Better Days, and I can tell you right now what to do. You hear that voice. It's your inner critic. It kept you safe when you were a child. It kept you from running out into the street or swimming out too far. But as a writer or as just a human being, it tells you to stay small and afraid because it wants to control you. And every writer on earth hears it. I heard it writing this new book somehow. I heard it saying, oh, for Pete's sake, there's no word more overused than love. And it would try to scare me or shame me into writing something more New York City, more erudite, more intellectual. Don't listen to it, okay? Promise me that you, when you hear it saying that, say, oh, it's just you. It's not truth. And get back to work on your book. I'm really proud of you. Good girl.
Karen, thanks so much and good luck. We've got about...
Yeah, thanks, Karen.
We've got about maybe a minute or so left. But I wanted to ask you about grace and what the role that grace plays in your life. And as you put it, the phrase you use is, grace always bats last. Can you just explain what that means?
Well, John Lennon, St. John, said something so great about 40 years ago. He said, everything turns out okay in the end. If it isn't okay, it's not the end. And I really believe that in Neil's book, Better Days, he says, life tilts towards the good. But when you're in the middle of a mess, when you're in the middle of loss, when you're in the middle of pain and bad self-esteem, it doesn't seem like it's going to turn out well this time. I always think, well, the jig is up. And then Neil reminds me, life tilts towards the good. And grace to me is like spiritual WD-40 that spritzes you when you're at your most clenched and knotted up. And you know, those long red tubes, those straws that come on the cans of W, it's like gets in there, gets into the nooks and crannies and gives you a little spritz. And you get a little second wind. You get a little bit of fresh air. And if you don't have that right now, you can ask for it. You can ask God for it. You can call your best friend and ask for it. Maybe he or she will take you to Target, and then you'll find grace there in the radical self-care of buying yourself a brand new, really great, expensive pair of socks. I think grace can look like a tangerine. It can look like a new pair of socks. It can look like standing in line at the express line and being sweet and flirty with somebody way older than you who's got coupons in the express line. And instead of like judging them, you just are sweet with them and tell them how much you like their hat. And that is offering grace to another person. That's offering sweetness and love and, you know, a little pick me up, which is what grace is.
Yeah. Anne Lamott, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Keith. I really enjoyed this. I love Maine. I was there for the first time last summer, and of course couldn't help but be blown away by its beauty.
Well, come and visit us.
We'd
love to see you. Anne Lamott's new book, which just came out, is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. And visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs. Also, if you sign up now, you'll be entered to win a Maine Calling mystery book bundle. Tomorrow on the program, we want to get your reaction to yesterday's eclipse. Was it all you hoped for? How are the crowds? How is the traffic? We encourage you to call or email. Or you can try our new voicemail app, Maine Public Vox Pop. That's Maine Public VOXPOP. It's a simple way to send us a voice message and it's available wherever you get your apps. I'm Keith Shortall, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.